The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, what we do in our practice is to look at things, look at experience that's in the way of freedom. So, for instance, a mind that's caught up in aversion or suffering is kind of that's what's in the way of freedom. And we find our way towards freedom by studying what's in the way of freedom, by getting familiar with the experience of aversion. And then wisdom begins to grow and develop that supports the mind to begin to have a new relationship with aversion, to begin to recognize it's not so helpful, to that it begins to fall apart. And it's very similar with, in a way, around the teaching of not self. We don't go looking for not self. The Buddha did say that it is through not understanding this truth of not self, that it is a truth. It's not something that we have to get rid of a self. It's not what we think it is. Whatever we are taking to be self is not what we think it is. And so that is a misunderstanding, essentially. And so the Buddha pointed to that misunderstanding around the sense of self being a thing, a permanent abiding entity, pointed to that misunderstanding as one of the fundamental reasons that we suffer. And so rather than trying to find the not self, we explore what we take to be self. We explore that side of the experience. And so that's what we've been largely doing the last few weeks of this discussion. So exploring what we take to be self helps us to understand that the experience that we take to be self doesn't function in the way that we might think it does. So we begin to learn something about those misunderstandings about the sense of self. The sense of self, we could say, the Buddha used the term identity view as one of the ways he talked about the sense of self. The Pali Sakaya Ditti, and Ditti is a commonly used term that refers to view. The Sakaya part is often translated as identity or personality. So Sakaya Ditti, personality view, identity view. And he's pointing to it as a view that this is one of the things that we take to be self is nothing more than a view, a belief of some aspect of our experience being kind of identified with as I or me or mine. And in many places in the teachings, the Buddha pointed to views in many forms, views about who we are, what we can do, what other people can do, views about the nature of the world, views in general, when we identify with them and attach to them, are one of the main sources of conflict in the world. I think we can see this in our culture right now, in the United States especially, how much views are contributing to suffering, contributing to not wars so much, but, you know, I think views do contribute to wars, but in this country, you know, to contribute to just a lot of separation, a lot of anger, a lot of hatred. That is happening because people are holding to views and are kind of reified around them, reinforced around them, so that they can't take in other perspectives, or they aren't willing to try to meet to have other perspectives. So the Buddha spoke about views in general as being a source of conflict. And many of the views that create suffering and pain in our world do have to do with identities, have to do with our sense of who we are, of what we're capable of, and a sense of who other people are. So this is kind of the exploration I'd like to look at tonight. We've been talking about looking at, in the past few weeks, around how we create identities for ourselves. But there's also another form of selfing that we could call othering, that we also attribute qualities, we have beliefs around other people. And I'd like to propose, this isn't exactly in the Buddhist teachings, but what I have kind of explored in my own experience, so this comes out some from my own practice, my own exploration of my sense of self, is that when I am kind of strongly identifying somebody else as other, there is a sense of self. When a sense of other springs up, it is a sense of self that's created. You can't have other without having self. And so they come together. So this, to me, has been a kind of an interesting way to explore aspects of a sense of self that I don't normally think of. When I start to see, in particular, the mind projecting or using they, them language or those people or something, that's a little bit of a clue that there's something going on, that there's an identity going on, some kind of a holding to something going on. And so the othering piece kind of betrays a clinging to some kind of an identity here. There was a question that was submitted just today about not self in the context of a collective identity. And I'm not going to explicitly respond to that directly right now, but some of what I talk about will be connected to that, be connected to that sense of group identity. So when we grow up, we grow up in a particular context, a group, perhaps, it might be, just where we live, we're surrounded by particular people or the people that we socialize with. We have a kind of a group that we are familiar with. And in a way, this forms, this has a piece of forming our identity of who we are based on the ideas, the views, the beliefs, the things that the people around us do. It's kind of like it's our culture in a sense. We grow up first perhaps in our own family or in an extended family or in a particular community where we are exposed to certain things more than other things. So this is a conditioning. It's part of our conditioning. This is the Buddhist teachings talk a lot about conditioning, how we are shaped, how our views, our ideas, our beliefs are formed. And a lot of that, our views of ourselves, our views about the world are formed based on the community that we grow up in. So we could call that, in effect, a kind of our initial collective identity, our initial identity with a group. We all kind of form one teacher that, not a Buddhist teacher, but a teacher of understanding diversity, Shakil Choudhury has a beautiful book called Deep Diversity that I really appreciate. And in that book, he talks about, you know, kind of that we each grow up in our own tribe. He uses the language of tribe. You know, that we're surrounded by people who tend to look like us, who we are shaped by the way that group does things. And so that is what we grow up thinking of as normal. That's what we grow up thinking of as the way people do things. And that's what we're exposed to. And so that is kind of our initial shaping. And it makes sense that for all of us, whatever community we grow up in, that's where we feel comfortable. You know, that's what we've been exposed to. That's what we've been shaped into. And so that's where we feel comfortable. So we tend to gravitate towards that comfort and familiarity. This is a very familiar piece around, you know, we go to what's pleasant. The Buddhist teaching on, you know, what is pleasant, we tend to like that. We want more of. What's unpleasant, we tend to not like that. We tend to not want to go towards that. And so whatever we're shaped by, whatever we become comfortable with in our families and our collective community, that's kind of where we might gravitate. And I know that this is not always the case. There are certain times people grow up in environments that are not, that are traumatic and that are, somebody is basically just surviving, and there's not a sense of comfort in that. So that also does happen. And that's a different kind of shaping, perhaps a shaping to want to find something different, find your way out of that. So I'm just talking more in general here about often how we're shaped by our communities, by our families. And so we tend to have this bias towards the familiar. It's, you know, this is what normal is, in a way. We tend to have that kind of shaping. We all tend to have some kind of shaping in that way. This is human. This is human. This is not, you know, what we grow up with. I think in this group, I've told this story. When I was in the Peace Corps, I spent some time in a village. I was in the Peace Corps in the South Pacific, where the community there is Melanesian, very dark-skinned people. And there was a baby, I mean, mostly there weren't too many white people around. And there was a baby that was born who, while I was there, who was given my name. So she became my namesake. And I went back. She was born. I got to see her, but then I went back. You know, she didn't remember me. You know, it was like, you know, months. It was like 6 months later. And I think she had not seen another white face, another white person in that whole 6 months. Because when she saw me, she just burst into tears. It was like she was afraid. I could just only imagine, like, you know, if she'd only ever seen these, like, warm, dark faces, and here's my face that looks like a ghost or something. It's like, it just looks weird. It looks wrong. And so even at the age, even at a very young age, you know, what we're surrounded by, what we're become familiar with, that's what feels right and normal. And when something is out of that range, it feels different. It feels uncomfortable. And so this is just human, this kind of conditioning. And so it can be useful to reflect, to spend some time reflecting on what kind of conditioning, what kind of collective, essentially, did you grow up in? What was that shaping that you had? Mostly we don't think about that until we start to meet other. Until we start to meet other other groups, other people. And then perhaps, you know, sometimes it might be, you know, if you're in a situation where you're, so in my experience, I didn't see very many people of color as a young child. And so seeing somebody who did not look like me, that did create a kind of a sense of separation, of that person is different from me. That person is different from my group, from my community. So there could be that sense of separation there in the othering. So I think othering can occur on a personal level. You know, it can occur, you know, just individual to individual. But I think often the othering happens based on group identities, based on, you know, what we're familiar with from our family and, you know, what kinds of many kinds of things, perhaps in, you know, skin color, gender, perceived differences in economic or social status, these kinds of things might be some of these differences of self and other, perhaps body language, how somebody expresses themselves in body, the accent of which somebody speaks, that might be a way that somebody is seen as other or different than me, the way people dress, all kinds of things that, you know, almost that a lot of these ways of what we think of as maybe kind of normal, you know, each of us having some kind of view of normal, anything that's different than that, and it can be many, many things, you know, many of these things that I just mentioned, many of those things can create that sense of self and other. So we may tend to have a kind of a bias to go towards or away from what feels different. We may tend to go towards people we perceive to be like us, or we may tend to go, it's possible, it, you know, certain times it may be that we tend to gravitate towards people that we think of are very not like us because again, perhaps a sense of maybe a feeling of constriction in our own identity, a constriction in our own place that we have, whatever tribe or whatever collective we have grown up with. So this is this exploration around othering. You know, it's important to just realize, and I hope it's clear in what I'm describing, that this is just a natural process, that it's conditioning that we do this. What is most important, I think, is to be aware of it and to be aware of the impact that it can have on ourselves, on others. Not only, so you know, there's just this separation or the sense of that person is not like me, you know, or that person is not like us. There can be the us, them, the me, you, the us, them. You know, there can be different ways this othering kind of has a flavor to it. Now, it might just simply be, you know, a little bit of a sense of startle. Oh, that's different. I'm not familiar with that. Kind of like the six-month-old baby seeing my face. You know, my guess is that six-month-old baby didn't have too many views and opinions about white people at that point. But there was still a startle. So there can be, you know, just the impact of difference can create a sense of fear, of anxiety, of separation. So that's important just to be aware of that piece of it, that the sense of that's different. Oh, You know, oh, does it make you feel uncomfortable? So noticing that experience, if you're seeing, you know, this is something we can explore in our lives, in our practices. We're going through our day and seeing people. How do we respond when we see somebody who looks different from us, or acts different from us, or dresses differently from us, or behaves differently from us? What happens? Is there a little bit of a constriction? Be aware of that. It's not something to berate ourselves for, but it is something to be aware of. But it's even more important in some ways to notice or to be aware, because along with that sense of separation, often kind of conditioned in with an us, them, me, other, is some kind of view or belief about other, about who the other is, about what they do, about how they are as people. So there's often a whole host of almost like subconscious at times views, beliefs around they and them when we're having that separation. And so it's really important to recognize not only the sense of that separation, but also, are there views, are there beliefs in there? So becoming aware of this whole process. I think for myself, becoming aware of the they, them language has been helpful. Becoming aware when I notice that of a little, perhaps sometimes actually the first thing I notice is a little bit of a feeling of separation, you know, with that sense of othering. There's a little bit of a sense of guardedness or something, a little bit of an emotional response. And so that can be one of the first things that can be useful to be aware of, and to let the mindfulness kind of be curious about that. For a period of time, I was exploring this when I would see somebody and have that little bit of a sense of, oh, that person's different from me. I had read a suggestion to kind of like, instead of seeing that person. And so often I think what happens is we see when there's othering going on, we are seeing that person not as an individual, not as who they are, not as what they're actually doing, but from a perspective of a whole bunch of views and beliefs and ideas about them. Views and beliefs and ideas about if we're taking them as a member of a group, for instance. Views and ideas and beliefs about the group, we're seeing not the individual, but we're seeing them as a member of a group sometimes. And so this is not seeing things as they are. It's bringing views and ideas and concepts as an overlay and not receiving the actual experience of the person, but taking in information from a view, from a perspective. This is a very familiar pattern, actually, in our minds. Any kind of perspective can filter in certain things, and you know, lets us take in certain things and not other things. So the piece that I found really fun to explore as I saw this kind of like. A little bit of separation, a little bit of a sense of othering. The question that I was encouraged to reflect on, and this came from the book Deep Diversity that I mentioned a few minutes ago, is to ask a simple question that's kind of personal and just really neutral. It's like, I wonder what kind of vegetables that person likes. This ended up being an amazingly powerful tool to it, like it broke through the sense of looking at somebody through a view and created curiosity. I wonder who they are. I wonder, maybe they like carrots. Maybe they like zucchini. Who knows? You know, it's like, but it just created a little bit of curiosity that broke through the habit of seeing from that perspective, that habitual perspective of other. We can feel shame when we see these kind of habits at work. You know, that these biases in our mind to have a sense of separation or a sense of distance when we see somebody who doesn't look like us. But again, you know, remembering this is based in a very human pattern. So it is just conditioned. The seeing of it is how the whole thing can become transformed and healed in many ways. How that separation between self and other can be healed and be kind of actually meeting people, not as other, but as kind of like an exchange of actual experience with somebody, not so much through our lens of ideas, but the actual meeting one person to another. So it needs to be seen, these patterns, these habits of the habitual pattern of identifying with our own collective, our own group, and perhaps othering with others. It needs to be seen. It can be seen with mindfulness, held with mindfulness, and a different perspective. So it's like we start to see through seeing the othering, we start to see ways in which we're holding a kind of a cold. My sense of the self, the othering, is that in many times when I find that selfing and othering happening, there is a kind of a protection identity arising. I need to be careful. I need to watch out or something. So, you know, it's something like that that is happening here internally, being projected on something externally. It's so humbling to see these views at work, but seeing them is way better than not seeing them. And there's so much to learn. And what I've seen too is that, you know, that simple question that I started to play with, it was so interesting to just have that little bit of curiosity. It was within a few months I found that my entire relationship to others radically changed. And it wasn't something I had to try to do. It just began to shift. It just began to alter. So one of the things, and this is the last piece because I see we're over by 2 minutes. I apologize for that. But I do want to just point to this exploration around selfing and othering. You know, it's not just about opening to our own struggles and suffering, because this pattern around selfing and othering is a big contributor to suffering in the world. That this pattern around othering, taking people to be different, foreign, or strange, or just not who I am, you know, that impacts the other person too. It creates suffering externally at times. Not always, but we're seeing a lot of that right now. We are seeing a lot of that right now, the suffering that happens in that othering. It's not just about freeing ourselves, our own hearts, from suffering. It is also about not putting that actions into the world that contribute to suffering externally also. So it's time to stop. And I think we'll look at questions again next week. So there's a little more time. Maybe that's how we have to do this, because it seems to me that the conversation, when I'm offering a teaching, it seems to take some time to unwrap that. So, but next time we can do some questions.